Thank you, Professor Sheikh, with sharing your opinion on this issue. We are going to Dr. Farahi. She's an independent scholar who teaches at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu. And I would like to ask Dr. Farahi to come and present her opinion. She has been to Iran last summer, and she has very eyewitness comments and opinion to share with us.
This is Farida speaking. Let me begin by just pointing out how happy I am to be here. This is indeed a very novel experience for me, and it's wonderful. I hope you hear me well. Let me begin by saying that Gary has mentioned much of what needs to be said regarding the nuclear impasse between Iran and the U.S. and, of course, increasingly the Europeans. So let me focus, hopefully in a rather systematic fashion, more on the Iranian politics aspect of the matter. Let me begin by saying that most of the discussion regarding Iran's nuclear program has focused essentially on Iran's attempts and in many ways inability to neutralize the international focus on its nuclear program. What has not been discussed as much is the internal politics that has thrown literally the nuclear issue right into the middle of the Iranian political discourse. When about 4 years ago I did a study of the domestic conversation about Iran's nuclear weapon program, I literally could not find people inside Iran who would acknowledge that Iran had a worthwhile or an existing nuclear weapons program. To be sure, there were sporadic discussions, particularly after Pakistan tested its bomb, about whether Iran should or should not pursue a nuclear weapons program. But when I asked questions about the nature of the existing program and the basic answer, even among those who thought Iran should not pursue a nuclear weapons program, was that there was absolute lack of knowledge and skepticism about the existence of such a program. In a word of one prominent reformist, the only thing nuclear in Iran was civil society. Now, as you all know, the situation has changed dramatically in the past couple of years, and now the Iranian nuclear program is at the center of the Iranian political discourse. Why this has happened, of course, has to do with the pressures that has come from the outside, external countries as well as the IAEA. However, I don't think these pressures would have led to the kind of contentious political discourse that exists in Iran had it not been for a very contentious political environment. The end result, I think, is that in a country known for its authoritarian ways, one of the most important foreign policy issues of the country has ironically become an open field of discussion, entailing very opposing views. And this open discussion has developed an interactive dynamics with the decision-making process. Interestingly, increasingly, forcing the decision makers to Iran to become more transparent and feeling the need to explain their decision. The point of contention, of course, is at this point what was known at the time the Saddlebad Agreement that was reached between the Europeans trio, and Iran in October 2003. The content of which itself is contested in terms of the length as well as the breadth of enrichment. This agreement, while a breakthrough for the Iranian government at the time, immediately created new problems for those who negotiated the agreement at the behest of the National Security Council. The most important and perhaps unforeseen problem was that it suddenly created a new and second task for the IAEA. As you all know, the agency's task was initially to deal with only one distinct set of issues, which had to do with the agency's verification of Iran's compliance with its legal obligations under NPT safeguard agreements. This is a technical and legal task, which was made easier by the fact that in the Saadabad Agreement, Iran agreed to follow or accept an additional protocol, put it in force, despite the fact that the parliament has yet to ratify that additional agreement. The agreement gave IAEA unrestricted access to all Iranian nuclear facilities, as well as the right to unannounced spot inspection. Now, it is important at this point to know that Iran's decision to put into effect the additional protocol has had some of its intended objectives. In his last report, the director of IAEA, Mr. Baradei, suggested, in fact, explicitly stated that the agency has made steady progress in understanding the nature and extent of Iran's nuclear activities. And more importantly for Iran, he also stated that no additional undeclared activities on the part of Iran have come to the light since the effective, since the protocol came into action. As a result of this open access, also Baradei suggested that some outstanding issues have been resolved. And finally, most importantly, for the first time, he suggested that one of the explanations that Iran had given regarding contaminated equipment being from the outside may indeed be considered plausible. He has not obviously given the final answer. Now, had the agreement with the Europeans been limited to the issue of signing the additional protocol, one could argue that the process could have perhaps taken its natural course, and after a while, provided no new evidence of non-compliance was found, would have ended in the closure of Iran's case at the IAEA. However, as we all know, the weight of evidence of past violations, although non-constituting evidence for an ongoing nuclear program, and the hostile international environment has actually led to a situation where in Saadabad, Iran also agreed to suspend its uranium enrichment program as a confidence-building measure. This actually gave the IAEA a task that it did not have before, the task of monitoring Iran's voluntary undertaking to suspend enrichment-related and reprocessing activities as a confidence-building measure. Now, as Gary pointed out very eloquently, why the Europeans insisted on this, we all know, had to do with the fact that the technological gap between peaceful nuclear energy program and nuclear weapons program has now narrowed so much that by halting domestic enrichment and hence preventing Iran from having a complete fuel cycle, the Europeans, along with Americans, hope to prevent Iran from a breakout capability, the capability to build a nuclear weapon and add an opportune time, leave NPT and actually build a bomb. On the other hand, the reason for why the Iranians accepted this was clearly stated by Foreign Minister Kharrazi in a very tense parliamentary session this summer. He said that Iran had to change the very hostile international environment that had been created, and this is why Iran accepted voluntary suspension of. He said emphatically and very clearly in the parliament that without temporary suspension, the case would not have followed its legal and technical course at the IAEA. What all these things mean is that the IAEA, as well as the European trio and the U.S., as Gary mentions, have now demands on Iran that go well beyond the obligations created by NPT. Within this context, cooperation with the agency now not only means transparency and full access, but also a rather one-sided confidence-building process, putting the negative burden of proof that the on Iran that they are not building weapons on in Iran. And the only way the Iranians can do this, presumably, is by not completing their fuel cycle. And here lies the domestic dilemma. In a highly transparent and public dynamic of the debate over what Iran should do, there is no way the Iranian leadership can afford to budge on the question of not being able to complete its fuel cycle. The problem is, of course, compounded by the fact that there seems to be a disagreement between the Iranian, on one hand, and the European trio, as well as the IAEA, on the content of the Saadabad Agreement, with the Europeans, along with the IAEA, arguing that Iran agreed to suspend all enrichment-related activities, which Iran has not done, and the Iranians insisting that it only entailed enrichment itself. At this point, it seems to me, it is really irrelevant whether the Iranian negotiators lied to the Europeans or lied to the Iranian public. Whatever the Saadabad Agreement was, the bottom line is that given the highly contentious domestic environment, the Iranian leadership can no longer follow through the agreement if the agreement indeed calls for suspension of all enrichment-related activities. Now, it may well be true that the Iranians are refusing to give in because they are pursuing a breakout capability, although I would think that if they were doing it, they would be very stupid to do it in the public fashion that they have done so in the past couple of years. Still, it can be granted that the Iranian leadership continues to try to keep all options open. Having said this, it is also important to understand that domestic politics in Iran has taken the issue out of a mere technical realm or a discussion of Iran's international commitments and has turned it into a question of national sovereignty. The Iranian government cannot be seen as giving in on this issue. Of course, as Gary also pointed out, the problem is complicated by the fact that regardless of the exchanges between the IAEA and the Iranian government, the Bush administration has appropriated the IAEA's position as a smokescreen for its ambitions for the region. In its last meeting in Vienna, for example, despite El-Baradei's expressed satisfaction, at least partial satisfaction, at the process of negotiation, John Bolton, for example, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, publicly stated that Iran's conduct does not bode well with a negotiated approach. This is despite the fact that George Bush, as Gary suggested, suggests otherwise. Bolton also explicitly used South Africa and Ukraine, countries whose nuclear weapons program were halted after regime change, as examples of how change can be brought about in the case of Iran's nuclear program. And also keep in mind that precisely at the moment of the IAEA meeting, as is usually the case, a series of perhaps orchestrated reports come out suggesting the possibility of military attacks against Iran by Israel. So here lies, let me end here, the Iranian government's dilemma. If the administration, the Bush administration point man for negotiating a settlement does not believe in negotiation and advocates the change of regime, change of the regime with which he's supposed to engage with, should Iran back down and negotiate with a state that openly advocates its overthrow? as discussed publicly in Majlis in the summer, wouldn't negotiations within this context simply mean more and more demands on Iran without any guarantees or at least benchmarks from the other side about when the pressures will be reduced? If so, wouldn't the only option left for Iran to stand is to stand her ground, play the same game of brinkmanship played by the Israelis and the Americans, and hold its nuclear program as a bargaining chip to be given away if and only if there are some guarantees from the United States, not Europe, that the bargain will lead to some sort of an end to American hostility? Now, I grant you that the game being played right now is a very dangerous one. But at this point, rightly or wrongly, Iran is banking on two things on its stance. One, American difficulties in Iraq preventing outright military attacks, and a tight oil market preventing multilateral sanctions via UN Security Council. But given Iran's highly contentious internal dynamics, as well as the kind of antagonistic position I just described regarding the U.S., the Iranian leadership seems to feel that it has no other choice but to play the hand it has been dealt. To be sure, the Iranian policymaking apparatus was extremely careless in handling the nuclear issue initially. But now that after a very intense and interesting debate at home, it has given open access to its nuclear and military facilities and is playing by all the international rules, it feels it has no other choice but to play a hardball game of call for negotiation, as Mr. Kharazic did this past few days, with all interested countries on one hand and brinkmanship on the other. Giving in on the question of enrichment indefinitely, in other words, giving in on something that it's entitled to, according to international law, the Iranian leadership feels, it seems to me, that it's not an option for it. And the Iranian contested and increasingly fractious, believe it or not, I do think that it's becoming even more fractious, will not allow it, particularly if United States insists on treating the bargain with Iran as a victory for United States that it has done in the case of Libya. Let me say just something about what Gary said about if indeed United States is getting ready to offer some negotiation to Iran, or at least embark on the path of negotiation on Iran, it's not clear whether the Iran will respond or not. I agree with Gary, but it's not because Iran has some predisposed plan to not negotiate with the United States. The reality is that given the fact that this issue has become so public and so contentious, that any discussion of negotiation with the United States ultimately has to go through this contentious process. And because of that, it becomes further politicized. And unless both sides are committed to continue this negotiation through hard times, easy times, and difficult times, these negotiations will break down. Either they will not be accepted from the beginning because the demands that are being put on Iran are deemed unreasonable, or they would break down in the process of negotiation. Thank you very much.